So, good afternoon, Professor Jones. Thank you very much for joining us. As we have discussed ahead of time, the theme of this conversation is the history of replica symmetry breaking and spinning glasses in physics, which we roughly bound from 1975 to 1995. That said, before we dive into that topic, I'd like to ask you a few background questions. First, can you tell us a bit more about your family and your studies before going to university?
I'm from a small village in North Wales. Little to say about my family. I'm a single man.
But I mean,
I
was science part of your upbringing? Were your
right.
parents interested in?
No, not particularly. Like many people, my f father was a soldier in the Second World War, and went to college after the war on an ex-serviceman's grant. So I'm the first member of my family to go to university.
I see. So how did you get interested in physics then?
I can only say it was at the grammar school I was at in Llandudno. It was a very traditional grammar school, and both mathematics and physics were well taught, I would say. So I really think I was quite lucky. The situation is different today. I mean, there's different school system in the UK from what there was, but the school I went to, traditional Welsh grammar school, which focused on, mathematics, physics, foreign languages, and literature and that kind of thing.
So what led you to pursue a PhD in theoretical physics with Sam Edwards then from that?
Well, I went to university. I was an undergraduate at Manchester, where I only discovered that theoretical physics, as a kind of sub-discipline in its own right, existed as I went through the course, and realized that this connection between mathematics and physics was absolutely fascinating. I didn't enjoy lab work, although I had to do it for a couple of years. I remember leaving the lab after my last experiment, thinking I'd never have to do any more. It was a kind of purgatory for me. However, Sam lectured to gave a third-year course in quantum mechanics to students who were specializing in theoretical physics. It was extremely difficult, but full of green functions, as you might imagine, and that kind of thing. But he really caught my imagination, and despite the difficulty I had of his unusual thought processes, they were different from that of many physicists I'd met. I was very, very taken by it. At the end of the process, I decided I would like to do a PhD in theoretical, joining together of maths and physics. They were particular undergraduate courses which I caught my interest, nothing to do with where I ended up. One was the link between special relativity and that kind of and the sort of mathematics of it, which caught my interest in the first and second years, and particularly in my third and final year, where you were starting to look at the covariant formulation of classical electromagnetism, which really got my interest a long way away. But that was the kind of thing that turned me on.
So, just, I mean, just a quick note. It's when you move, actually, that the sound adjusts and the noise level fluctuates a lot.
Okay.
So, if you can, I apologize, but if you can find a comfortable position, it'll be easier. Otherwise, we lose you every time you just move.
Fine. Raise a finger if you can't hear me.
Okay, thank you. So we heard this is how you met Sam Edwards, and then.
I lectured to an advanced quantum mechanics course, which was taken by the theory students. We were a very small group of about six out of 140 were selected to do this, and it's done by interview. And I remember Sam was on the small panel that interviewed me. I remember him asking, "Well, if you want to do a PhD here, what area of physics do you want to work in?" And I said I have a pretty open mind. I said the only one thing that I really didn't want to work in was nuclear physics. Sam Beings, did you know Sam Edwards yourself or either of you?
No.
He's from South Wales. I said, oh, yes, that's all right. That's all right. So I ended up when I returned to the university that September as one of Sam's research students.
And how did you get to select or pursue a thesis topic on spin waves in particular? How did that come about?
I remember Sam said he would take me on as a student. I was first going to work on, he was talking about some work possibly involving the use of functional integrals in classical statistical mechanics, the use of collective coordinates, if you like, which you're integrating over densities and what have you. And I worked on this some time, and somebody in the coffee room said to me one day, oh, Ray, he said, I think there was a paper in JMath Phys which might be of interest to you. And it was everything that I'd started doing, what I was going to do. So we had a change of track. And Sam was, of course, interested in disordered systems very much at that time. And he was talking about, he was starting to talk about disordered magnetism. And he said, I'm going down to Harwell, which the Atomic Energy Research Establishment, which is a very high grade theory group. John Hubbard was in charge of the theory there. And I spent two summers there whilst doing my PhD because they were good people to talk to. But I got some ideas then, and Sam would sort of throw ideas out at you, and the whole topic of disordered systems, which in those days was rather more something with a crystalline structure, but with the disorder, in my case, missing spins, which shouldn't have been there, and you wanted to know what happened to the excitations. It's now old hat, of course, but it wasn't in those days. There was a very, very important group in Oxford working on this as well.
Yeah, so you worked on a particular model that you called the localized Heisenberg Hamiltonian, whose structure is very similar to that later studied by Edwards and Anderson. Where did the idea for the particular model come from?
We're moving on now from my time when I was working doing calculations in disordered spin systems for my PhD. I moved to
in your thesis, you have.
I knew about the basic. It was a basic discussion about things called spin glasses. I didn't know really what they were, and I don't think I started looking at these things until I was a postdoc, and I moved to London.
Yeah. So, but the Hamiltonian you describe in your thesis, you have the RKKY. Coupling, yes, between two spins, yeah. And so that you call the Heisenberg Hamiltonian disordered, I think, and then you have a localized version of it, which is just with nearest neighbor.
Sure, yeah. Well, it's a reason I worked on that. It was easier to handle short range forces, and that it was a mathematically tractable problem. It's quite a good PhD problem, I think, and.
But you were the first one to work on this particular model, I think, right? You did. It's not a model that was in the air that you studied from or inspired by someone else. Is that correct?
I'm trying to think now. I think it's a long time ago, and trying to connect the different bits of what I was doing and what time is not easy. And I don't want to mislead anyone.
Fair enough.
So it's really a question of being aware that in some of these systems you could have localized spins, you could have itinerant models, but I was interested in the the localized bins, and then you just simplify the problem with, you know, RKKY is with a one over R cubed with a cosine oscillations. You know, clearly you had randomness in a real system in the coupling between spins, but it became rather more tractable.
In your thesis, you describe these models as forming local clusters of ferromagnetically ordered magnetic moments with anti-ferromagnetic couplings. So I guess you have domains that are was that the general understanding of these systems at the time?
I'm moving off my thesis work now into what I was doing, started thinking about, but didn't really pursue until I was a postdoc.
Okay.
So what my thesis work was concerned with working out the spin wave spectra of these localized models with Heisenberg Hamiltonian with missing spins. You know, there's a big industry in these things at the time.
I think you ended up publishing only part of your thesis. Is that correct? And if yes, why? Why is that? What happened?
Nothing particular. I mean, I published published two papers with Sam. One was on the ferromagnetic problem. The other was a less good attempt, I think, on the problem of antiferromagnetism in a disordered system, which is, we now know, is a rather much more complicated issue. That was quite normal.
No, I'm just saying this because you had a paper called Part One, and the Part Two never appeared, or at least I couldn't find it. So that's why I was.
I see. You've really been hunting, yeah.
So during your time in Sam's group, did you hear about the work he was doing on rubber using the replica trick at the same time? Yeah.
Yes, of course. Sam was very, very busy. He had, if I remember correctly, he had 12 research students and two postdocs. Most of them were starting to work in polymers and, you know, the sort of allied topics. I wasn't, but that was really happenstance.
Okay, so he would, can you tell us a bit about the group? Would he be presenting his results? Would there be group meetings? Would there be discussions?
We had the weekly seminars for the theoretical physics group, which was, had nuclear physicists, field theorists, general condensed matter theorists, which probably focused on Sam's work. And Sam was a rather unconventional solid-state physicist. But as far as formal meeting subgroup, Sam's students, we didn't do it. You just knocked on someone's door if you wanted to say, what was he talking about yesterday? Because you hadn't understood something. And Sam was very patient in many ways. But sometimes you had to go and talk to people who knew him better than I did at the time to try and latch on to what he was, the thought processes. It was what was going on in his mind, what he wrote down on paper, as you may be aware when you've read one of Sam's papers. It's not all this. There's clearly something very strong in his physical intuition for the problem that doesn't always appear because of the particular mathematical language he uses to express it in.
So you've mentioned your postdoc already a couple of times. Yeah. What drew you to do a postdoc at Imperial College with David Sherrington, I think?
I knew David. David had been was an assistant lecturer in theoretical physics at Manchester, and he'd been a tutor in the hall of residence in which I'd lived.
Oh.
I completed my PhD in 3 years and realized I had to get find something to do. I mean, I clearly wanted to take things further. And I think David by that stage was at Imperial, and I contacted him for advice, and he pointed out that there were isotopes. David was part of Brian Coles's metal physics condensed matter group in Imperial College, and they were setting up a solid state theory part of the condensed matter group there. So there was David Sherrington and Nicolas Rivier, who I think he's now back in Switzerland, but I'm not sure. So that they were basically relatively young lecturers, and I was, I think, David's first postdoc, and Nick Rivier had had somebody else as a postdoc. So I David suggested, really said, why don't you apply for one of these ICI fellows? He says, competitive. There'll be an interview, and indeed, I went down to the Senate House of the University of London, where I was interviewed by a big panel, some of whom were wearing gowns. It was really rather intimidating. And I was lucky enough to get one of these fellowships. So I started as soon as I had got my PhD, I started in London. So I'd known David already, and it was a very happy relationship, as it was with Sam. And he'd been a student himself, so very successful one.
Can you describe a bit how the groups were working with Nicolas Rivier, Coles, and Sherrington at the time? Was there much interactions, or was this also?
I shared an office with Dave because there was an accommodation shortage there, and Nicolas Rivier shared an office with David Pettifor, who was the other postdoc. And the research students were also on the same floor as where the laboratories were. So people did talk to each other. And I think that's where I first became aware of some of the work on spin glasses, the experimental work that had been done by John Mydock, who was spending time with the experimental group. So we were all in one floor of the Imperial College. Very nice place to have sharing an office. I could look out of the office window when the prom concerts were starting in the Albert Hall. I could just look out at the back door and see when the queue was getting too long, and I could nip out and get a ticket. Very well placed.
So you said this is the first time you heard about spin glasses. So you were there when John Mydosh first came to visit? And
yes. I think John was part of the group, either new or I can't remember. It's 50 years ago.
Sure.
Yeah, but I know that it was the idea, and Brian Coles was always talking about this, and these odd Kupperman manganese alloys that apparently had magnetic order, because you measure the susceptibility, you've got a cusp. If you, in the absence of a field, if you put a field on, that cusp turned into a bump. And Nick Livier was looking at different aspects of that problem. I wanted to work initially on something different from that, because I'd done a PhD in disordered magnetism. So David proposed that I did some work on actually rare earth physics, and calculations of spin wave spectra in the rare earths. The story was really quite interesting, because I think it was a 2-year postdoc at that stage, and I remember Brian Coles coming into the office and saying, "You should." He said, you know, you ought to think. I know, he said, I know you've got another 18 months left in the group. But he said, you ought to think about what you'll do after this. And he said, I noticed there's a lectureship in mathematical physics going in Birmingham. Why don't you apply? Because it'd just be good practice for when you seriously want a job. So that was why I only spent a year. Lectureships were like jewels. I applied for the Birmingham job and was lucky enough to get it. As I regretted not having longer as a postdoc, because it was a very, very fertile group to be in. Brian Coles, Dave Sherrington, there was alive new ideas, and I learnt a lot. I think I could have learnt even more had I had another year there.
So as you said, you started at Birmingham quite quickly, and you had a PhD student, I think, work with you also, Gary John Yates. And you kept on working on spin waves in materials.
That's right.
So
Yeah. Yeah.
what drove you, what or what kept you interested in this problem? What was driving your interest?
It was really the chance of a research student. There was a problem there that was worth exploring, and which a research student would enjoy, and it's one in which I felt I could give very strong support. But gradually I did. What didn't take very long before Mike Kosterlitz was actually part of the mathematical physics department in Birmingham. He was a postdoc in particle physics, and he told me later that he I think he was a bit bored with the goings on there, and he thought he spotted rightly that David's talents, and he went to see if there were some interesting problems that could be worked on in a basically condensed matter area.
So when did you become aware of Sam Edwards' work and model on for spinning glasses?
Much, much later. The pay is Sam's, Edwards and Anderson, the critical papers. I think I read them very much later than that, but I'm not sure. Time, I'm not sure. I
So
was
he
aware
didn't
of
come to visit to Birmingham, or you didn't keep in touch with him that you would have heard of this
I
work
did.
before.
I did because when I started talking to David Thewlis and Mike Kosterlitz about some of these problems in magnetism, I got interested, of course, in what the properties of random matrices, because as a kind of possibly a model of RKKY, something with fluctuating signs, yeah. I'll tell you a story, if I may, about this.
Absolutely.
I was coming out of the solid state physics conference, which was being held, I think at Manchester, I'm not sure. And I got bored stiff, actually. I was in the second plenary talk, and somebody had made specific heat measurements on some compound that I wasn't particularly interested in. So I thought I'll creep out and get a cup of coffee. And as I did, I heard a whisper from the dark. He says, "Is that Ray? Is that Ray?" And there was Sam sitting on the front row. He said, "Are you bored as well?" He said, "Shall we go out and have a cup of coffee?" So we went out and had a chat about, how life was going. We talked about music, which is an interest of his and mine. And then, what you're doing. And I said, I started to think about random matrices because of the link with random magnetism. But I'd looked at, do you know this literature? Is this your area or not? Yeah. It's the work by Mater. I think that's right, isn't it? Yes. And it's really algebraically fearfully involved. And I could get the little feel. And one of the published results seemed to be in error by a factor of root two. Seemed to be. It might have been me. It might have been that. And I thought, how can I check this? And it was the semicircle law that, of course, I'm thinking about. And Sam said, "Oh," he said, "you should. There's another way of thinking about this." And he started talking about. He said, "The problem you've always got in the here there is averaging logarithm." And I didn't know this, but he'd used this trick about 5 years before in his polymer work. You probably find the references to it. I didn't know this. But Sam just got a piece of paper and sketched something out. Log is he had a curiously, he said it's the coefficient of n as n goes to zero in the expansion or something. I thought, what the hell does he mean? Because I put two and two together later. And he said, "I think you should be able to think of the problem this way and use polar coordinates in replication." And I thought, well, so what? So I just went away. I thought, this is an interesting problem on its own. And I did the, I got the, I went and did the semicircle law, redid the calculation, but in a way using the replication method. I then thought what we ought to be able to do is to extend this to the case where the JIJs you're dealing with have a finite non-zero mean, positive mean. Okay, so that instead of having something which is a normal distribution with mean zero, it's got a finite thing because it was in my mind, it might have something to do with magnetism. So I got the result out for what happens when you have a random matrix ensemble with a finite mean as well as the normal distribution, and that was in the paper that Sam and I wrote. Sam by this time had become chairman of the Science Research Council, which is the most powerful. Are you aware of this powerful scientific government? It's the interface between government funding and funding coming into universities. So Sam's sort of political interests in science politics were taking off, as well as having this huge collection of research students and what have you at Manchester. But I remember I did these calculations, and I contacted Sam at SRC and said, "Look, I've written up this work we were talking about over coffee. Would you be interested in a joint publication? But if so, then you better see the manuscript." And Sam, of course, was furiously busy. So I said, "Well, if we want to find time to discuss it, then maybe you could come up to Birmingham and give a seminar on whatever you want." And Sam said, "Oh yes, what a good idea!" And I think he was just glad to get away from, So Sam came up, and we had a useful talk, and he made some nice comments and small changes in the manuscript. So the thing that got published is what being through that kind of checking process. One of the things I discovered later was I got into trouble with the Vice Chancellor's office because I'd had the I was running the seminars at the time, and I'd invited the chairman of SRC to come up to Birmingham to give a talk, which he was delighted to do, physics, and hadn't told the VC's office. You can perhaps picture the situation.
Yes.
But then we started, David Thewlis, Mike Kostelis, and I started talking.
So before we jump into that, I'm just trying to understand these discussions you were having with Sam. This is prior to his work with Phil Anderson, or it's contemporary to it, or it
It
comes
would have
later?
been, I would guess it's roughly contemporaneous. I mean, Sam had mentioned to me the ideas of what a spin glass was, and of course I'd picked it up for the Imperial, the experimental problems there. And but I didn't, because I hardly knew Anderson or knew of him, and I certainly wasn't aware that he was pursuing that. At least I don't think I was.
So the paper got published later than Edwards and Anderson's series of papers, so your paper with him, I mean, on random matrices got published later, but that's largely because of I guess you were busy with other things, or
I guess so, yes. And there was also some work that Sam had done on random matrices. Sam's name is with Mark Warner at Cambridge. And Sam said, "Oh," he said, "could I?" I think Sam had asked me, "Could I just have a look at it before it went for, Mark published it?" And it arrived from Mark, and I made some comments, so it went back, and of course was published about 3 years later. I'm sure the work was done sooner than that.
I see. I see. So said as you said, you went after that work. You went and talked to your colleagues, Kostelitz and Thewlis, at Birmingham.
It was. I really. One of the things was worrying me about talking. Not quite. I'm not absolutely sure. of the right sequence of what happened 50 years ago, because there was a great flurry of activity over a short period.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know that the paper that Sam and I wrote on random matrices with a finite mean was criticized by two other authors who said it was just wrong. And I really was pretty confident it wasn't, and started talking to Mike and David about this. And there was indeed a serious error in this other paper, and which got a different answer, completely different answer. Well, our finding was that if you had a finite mean, then you got an isolated eigenvalue that splits off from the semicircular band, and when the mean is bigger than the variance, it just forms an isolated eigenvalue outside the band and sits there. And once it's absorbed in the band, it's a minor resonance, which is neither here nor there. And they came up with a completely different answer. And I started talking to Mike, and it was really quite productive, because I realized that when we were getting together, that you could make the problem mathematically looked a little bit like the problems which I did know a bit about of isolated impurities in a solid. You know, you put a heavy mass in a chain, and then all the tricks by the people who would do an orthogonal transformation, put the impurity which is at the origin on the top left hand side of a matrix, and you treat it as a kind of perturbation, you can solve the problem exactly. And I realized that you could do this, and whether it was David's suggestion or mine, I'm not sure, but that's what we used, and we were able to reproduce Sam and I had got on the random matrix thing in an unambiguous way. We found the mistake in the other paper, so it was quite interesting to do this. And but it was, David Thouless. Did you know him? I mean, he was ferociously talented and very, very quick. And it was, you had to say, again, sorry, can you repeat that? And his understanding of everything was so deep that I was very, very lucky to be working with him. And of course, the work that Mike Kostelitz and David Thouless were doing on the topological phase transitions was starting at that time. Mike by that time had a permanent lectureship in the subgroup in mathematical physics, so there were that's how it worked. And then we realized that you could I can't remember what led us to it. I got used to the replication method, and then realized that I don't know whose suggestion it was, again I really don't. But we realized that the nice thing would be to find there'd been the Sherrington Kirkpatrick paper, which is a bit of something of an inspiration, I think, for starting work of a lot of authors on these problems. I mean, I reread it recently. It's not an easy paper, but it's very nice. And David, I mean, Sherrington and Kirkpatrick were worried about the interchange of the limits, little n goes to zero, capital N goes to infinity. And obviously, it's at the end of their PRL, some problems associated with this, in particular, their model gave a negative t goes to zero. And that, of course, in the kind of model with discrete spins should not be the case. You didn't expect that.
Mm-hmm.
So they were well aware and flag it up, and they were speculating that was the problem. And then we thought, well, we can't solve that problem, which is the spin half EC model. Well, up down. If you can't get an exact solution of that, let's see if there's anything else we can look at. And that gave the idea of the Berlin cats, spherical model, which was beautiful. I mean, it came out really quite quickly, and I think as a model of a real physical system, it isn't. But it was the first. I mean, in the sense, it's a theorist's dream. It turned out to be an exactly soluble problem, and that's where our PRL on that came from. I mean, but it did lead to. It did lead to David was worried about the problems in Sherrington Kirkpatrick, which pursued this further.
So before we go in this direction, I have a couple of questions. So if I understand correctly, the work on the spherical model came after your work on the random matrices, and you having had discussion with Dave and Mike about the random matrix confusion. Yes. Okay.
It was, roughly speaking, honestly, there wasn't a lot of time. There was a lot of work done in a short period. And I think one thing, because we were talking about random matrices and the spin systems, and that they were, and then I think Sherrington Kirkpatrick's seminal paper came out at about the same time. So I'm not quite sure what kicked what off.
So you also mentioned CAC's model. So Mark CAC had obtained also a similar result to the one you obtained with Sam Edwards a few years before, but did not publish it. So I was curious if you, there was a preprint, I think, that circulated, but it never came out to print until decades later. So I was curious if you're aware of that, or if that had ever popped on your... No, okay.
I met CAC once, and he came and gave a seminar, and Sam introduced me when I was a research student. But
oh, really?
That was the only time. But there were a couple of off prints, which I don't know where. I probably still have them somewhere, but I'm retired now. I don't have quick access to some of these old things. And there was one by CAC, but I cannot remember for the life of me what it was about. I think it was something to do with impurities in an otherwise ordered system. I'm not sure. Sorry.
So, okay, but this was in the late 60s. So this would have been 68, 69 while you were a student that you...
Yes, this was at the time when I was doing my PhD.
Okay.
I went PhD in about 1970.
So Mark CAC and Sam Edwards knew of each other and that even met...
Oh, yeah, well, yes. Well, you know that Sam had been at Princeton. I think it was Princeton, wasn't it?
Possibly, yes.
He was a student. He was a student of Schwinger. And that's how he got interested in functional integration and field theory. And then that had inspired...
Okay, so I'd met Mark CAC at that time.
Already. He must have been, you know, it's a distinguished physicist.
So you were, before I interrupted you, you were mentioning Thouless and Kosellitz's interest in the spin glass conundrum and the surprises about. So what was your impression of their interest? I mean, were you following closely their interests and their discussions? How was that?
Oh, on the work on spin glasses, yes. And they had a very talented Brazilian research student, Jairo de Almeida. I don't quite know where he is now, but there's a couple of papers, some of which have my name on, but they all have Kosellitz and Thouless, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. And David was worried. It's typical of his insight that when he looked at the way that Sherrington Kirkpatrick had done it and the way everything else was handled, you tried to use the Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation, you know, the auxiliary field identity, call it what you will, and you look for extrema to do the integrals. You look for extrema in which the auxiliary field you're using is independent of the replication indices. You know, you've got two indices in each spin. One is the site, one is the replica you're sitting in. Mm-hmm. And that leads to, in the case of SI.SJ, it leads to things like an auxiliary field, which is Y alpha beta, which couples to the okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was interested in that, and he began to get, because the Sherrington Kirkpatrick thing, which on you couldn't see quite why the negative entropy was there. You know, they were quite open about Sherrington and Kirkpatrick were quite open about, you know, the fact that it probably shouldn't be. And was it the n, big N goes to infinity, little n goes to zero? But David Thewlis then said, then began to wonder if one maybe should not be looking at having just one auxiliary field, a Y, instead of a Y alpha beta. In other words, you do not break replica symmetry. And David wondered if that was the source of the difficulty. I think he's probably right. And that led to, I'm trying to think now the order in which. Yeah, he did. He wrote a paper with Jaro Dale Maeder in which they looked at the stability problem. They said, okay, let's suppose we leave a Y alpha beta as the auxiliary field in and expand it out the replica symmetric Y with a little bit extra. And they looked at the quadratic terms, which you end up with an exponential, and say for stability, then all the eigenvalues of this ought to be either all positive mm-hmm. or negative, you know. It's, and the essence of the paper that David Thewlis and Jaro Dale Maeder wrote was very nice, but horrendous algebraic calculation. They actually found the eigenvalue
form and found that indeed there were problems in which you switched over from being on a maximum, either a maximum to a minimum, as you went, then goes to zero. And that would seem to be, although the calculation they did was not complete, they saw that in the high temperature region, that is above what would have been the spin glass transition temperature, Sherrington and Kirkpatrick, and the work that they were doing with Dale Maeder, got identical results. Once you got into the spin glass phase, that it looked as if there was a sign change and you're looking at a maximum of the free energy or something. And it was that seemed to be that you got different form of different expression for the free energy at low temperatures. And they suggested that maybe replica symmetry breaking should be looked at.
So you mentioned the work you did with Jairo and Mike and David about the finite M component version of the model. You had looked at a spherical one.
Well, that was interesting because our spherical model was the standard spherical constraints. The sum of all the SI squareds is N. And David, and I don't know quite where it started, but David and Mike went over to the United States for the summer and said, could I look after Jairo? And, you know, it was a great pleasure to do so because he's one of these really strongly self-propelled students. And it was just a pleasure talking to him. And that's how Jairo did much of this work, almost unsupervised. He'd knock on my door occasionally and check, and is it reasonable to do this? You know, it's a pleasure to work with people like that. And investigating. I think I might have suggested seeing if you could look at the M component model. I'm not sure. I don't want to claim anything which wasn't my ideas, but see if you could get the same, essentially reproduce the results we've got. And indeed, you can get exactly the same results, but only when the number of spin components is infinite. You mm-hmm. cannot take a limit. You can't. It cannot be less than infinity. It's got to be there, and then that ensures. I think you find that the quadratic form ceases to be positive. It becomes positive semi-definite or something. I can't remember. But it's you could see where the problems were coming, and you could see that you're going to end up in that, as in the other work, you're going to end up on the wrong, some sort of wrong branch of a free energy. Mm. And that was, again, I thought was a great piece of work from Gyro.
Very nice. But I think after that collaboration with Gyro, you largely left the field of random matrices and disordered systems.
Yeah.
What drew you away, or what took you away from
there were people. David had published a paper with Phil Anderson, which they used a form of diagrammatic expansion in the mean field theory. It was in Phil Mag, I think it was,
mm-hmm.
which again explored this business about the eigenvalues, and it backed up the work that that Gyro had been involved with, and you know, the spherical model work that we'd done. But I was aware that there were other people starting to think about breakdown of replica symmetry. One of which was Mike Moore, and his group in Manchester. I think it was Mike who eventually tracked me down. I'd retired and wasn't using my university email, so he got through to Mike Gunn and said, "I've been trying to contact Ray because they've got two collaborators in the United States want to talk to somebody. So you need to talk to Mike about his views." But he got really quite interested, and I decided not to take that any further, and got involved in some rather different problems.
So did you nevertheless keep abreast of the work that was happening in these ideas of replica symmetry breaking? And
not really, no. I had a succession of other students and different problems I worked on. The end of my career, I had some very, very talented research students and we were looking at some models of propagation, waveguide propagation, which you could handle with path integration. You know, you connect together two fiber optic guides, you know, the sort of thing that stick down your throat or something, and if you're unlucky, and join them together, and you put a coupler between them, and you want to work out how much energy goes from one to the other, and you can set this thing up as a problem in path integration. And the engineers were using brute force on these things, and we found a whole series of problems where you could get a coupling shape. You know, you essentially model the thing by saying you've got a refractive index, which in a optical fiber is uniform everywhere, but then you want to encourage total internal reflection and all the rest of it. And what shapes of a coupling thing can you use to and actually solve politically? And that was really the last major. Published a whole series of paper with Kostas Konstantinou, who now has a chair in engineering in Birmingham. It was one of these things where my knowledge of solid state physics and that area of physics, suddenly I was asked if I could talk by some colleague I knew, somebody I'd lectured to actually as a student I taught an elementary mathematics course in the engineering department for a number of years at the beginning of my career, and there was a very, very talented guy there, Mick Mailer, who became the director of eventually became the BT research laboratories at Martlesham. And you remember him phoning me, I said, "Do you remember me, Ray?" He said, "You lectured to me." Yes, yeah, of course I do. I mean, he was ferociously gifted. I do remember that. And he'd gone away, and he'd using the techniques of differential geometry to solve antenna problems. So he'd learnt up general relativity in order to do this. So we're still in contact. But he said, "I've got a research student who's talking about path integrals and everything. Do you know what they are?" And I said, "Well, yeah, it's part of, you know, the background of any
any theoretical physicist, I may not be an expert in it, but yeah, I know what they are. He said, could you talk to this guy who is Kostas Konstantinou, who is Cypriot, very, very talented and a good friend of mine now. I ended up supervising his PhD when he was supposed to be doing a PhD in electrical engineering. And we got, I think, 6 papers out of it. All these different ways of modeling the doing the path integration, and then that work was taken over by another. I was very lucky actually that my last research student in Birmingham, a man called Paul Hollister, who's now no longer working in academic area. He took over and did some beautiful sort of variational type calculations, which backed up some of the analytical work that we'd done. It's the problems you get in quantum mechanics where you've got an imaginary, e to the I instead of a sort of statistical mechanics thing, the e to the minus. I published a whole series of things in that, and then several other things in the middle. So I didn't return to the other things that I pricked up my ears if somebody was talking about it.
So do you have any insight into how your Birmingham colleagues reacted to replica symmetry breaking ideas, or you're already disconnected from them?
I think we'd all got Mike, and eventually, of course, Mike and David moved to the USA. It's a great, great loss for us. Your gain, perhaps, definitely. David, of course, died only relatively recently, and I saw Mike and David in 2018 when the university gave them an honorary degree here, and that just after they'd won the Nobel Prize.
So during your time at Birmingham, or did you ever teach about spinning glasses, or that only remained a...
No, I gave a general postgraduate course in statistical mechanics doing simple renormalization calculations when a lot of especially the experimental people would hear the language, but they didn't really know what it was about. Mm-hmm. Mike Kostelis, I remember, gave a short course on RG methods before he left Birmingham, and then I had a sabbatical, for a term sabbatical, so I decided it's time I learned this stuff up properly, or an approximation to properly. So I learned quite a lot from that.
So is there anything else you would like to share with us about that era that we may have overlooked or missed?
It was, for myself, I think I was extremely lucky. I worked with Sam Edwards, who was an absolute inspiration, even if not the easiest person to follow. And he was so busy. When you read his papers, I mentioned this earlier, you can see that there's ideas there, but they're not, or doesn't all come through the mathematics. I was rereading the just to remind you before we talk. I thought Sam really knew about all of this inside, and he regarded some of the rest of the work, this is my guess, as being tidying up details at the edges. That was his style, perhaps, of doing physics. And then working with Mike and David was an inspiration. Mike was actually a very good friend, and we occasionally would play squash together or go out for a curry. But David, I would see at concerts, and I think it was with time that I just realized how talented these two people were. Very different ways, perhaps almost orthogonal in ways of thinking and ways of expressing themselves. But I just think I was very lucky, and to be able to become part of that. I make no claims for my own abilities, of course, really, but I just think I was lucky. And at that particular time, the spin glass and the replication
work was really rather beautiful. I was quite pleased with the first paper with the Anders I wrote with Sam. I was really quite pleased with it. It was, you know, it was quite elegant in some ways, and I was quite pleased with that. Is there anything else you'd like to ask?
Yeah, I mean, there's just one last question, right? In closing, do you still have notes or papers or correspondence from that epoch? And if yes, do you intend to deposit them in an academic archive at some point?
I don't know. At some stage, I need to go through. I retired when I was 67, and I continued working but just teaching for 5 years after that, and then COVID came. And I've only recently gone back in and trying to sort out. I've still got an office, but I'm going to eventually will get kicked out of that as the predators come. And it's interesting though. I'll see if I can locate the cat's paper. I do remember Sam Edwards's secretary in Manchester once. She hadn't been told how his name was pronounced. And she said, "Do you know him? We've got Professor Ack coming." And it was a great amusement.
Thank you very much for your time and for this conversation.
Is that helping? And I'm sorry, I'm vague on an awful lot. It was a long time ago, and you know I've now really quite disconnected. So I've done what I can do, hard work, trying to read some of these papers that I was involved with and that other people did, but I'm just very lucky. David Sherrington, Sam Edwards' PhD supervisor, David Sherrington, very different kind of physicist, and has you know this very important paper with Scott Kirkpatrick, and then the work I've done with Mike and Mike and David Thallus, Mike Austin, David Thallus.
Thank you.